Okay, well, thanks very much. This talk wasn't even going to happen until last week when I approached Baylor and I kind of invited myself to give an invited seminar. So I'm an engineer, so I'm allowed to do antisocial things like that. But anyway, so but thank you very much. It's been a real privilege to be part of this experience. And yeah, the institute and staying in the residence has been beautiful. Paul, your talk last week, you showed the picture of your kids the last time you stayed here in the present time. And I had a similar, I guess, first time with my family on the weekend, and it was such a novelty. But so anyway, so thanks again, Baylor and Paul and Brad. It's been a real treat for me to be here. And and the reason I approached Baylor last week about giving an invited talk was because what I wanted to talk about was Aeolian morphodynamics and Aeolian processes. And so this is a good one, in my opinion, for a couple of reasons. So one is, it turns out it's a very rich problem for turbulence, as you'll see in a few moments, and as I'll show you. Also, it's one that is not something that's just confined to our planet. In fact, it happens on other planets and moons throughout the solar system. So Earth and Mars and Venus and Titan are the ones that that are known to have Aeolian activity. And so today I'm going to show things from Earth and Mars, but you could think broader than that. And then also there are inherent nonlinearities upon the scaling of Aeolian movement of sand and dust. And so since it's not linear, it, as I mentioned, it ends up being a very rich problem for fluid dynamicists, because everything is disordered and chaotic. And so I normally like to start my seminar with this slide, and I don't know if it's too obvious for this group, but I end up finding that these are a very pleasant way to think about fluid mechanics, especially environmental fluid mechanics. So what you see on the ordinate here is the characteristic length, so how big the problem is. And so it's in meters and it's in log scale. So 10 to the 0, you know, that's about how big we are. So 10 to the negative 3 is a millimeter, so to the negative 6 is a micron, to the negative 9 is a nanometer. And then I'm showing turnover time, or characteristic time, in seconds here on the abscissa. So you could think about this as 1 divided by the frequency of the problem. And so, I don't know if this is too obvious, but I thought I'd show it anyway, since I normally show it. And so, you could imagine then that, if this is length is the ordinate, and turnover time is the time scale, that you could imagine if you have rays emanating from the origin of this, well, this would be the direction of things that are smaller and faster, and this would be the direction of things that are larger and slower. Okay. And so I put a couple of superlative length scales here. So the first one here is the diameter of Earth. So this is a bit bigger than 10 to the 7. So here's the diameter of Earth. And then Mars is our planetary neighbor, and is a little bit smaller than Earth. So here is Mars. And then another one here is relevant to oceanography. A little bit bigger than 10 to the 6 is the diameter of the Gulf of Mexico, approximate, you know, the engineer's diameter of the Gulf of Mexico.
And you're from Texas.
And I'm from Texas too, so I couldn't help myself. I have to, ethnocentric Texan, you know. So here is turnover time on the abscissa. So here is one that's also kind of a fun thing to think about is, here there was the professor from Princeton, I forget his name, but he was talking about Milankovitch cycles, which are these long-term changes in the obliquity of the Earth's axis, and these are associated with natural glaciation and melting of the ice caps, okay? So one thing I always like to do is you can show that, and I think for most of this room it'll be a receptive message anyway, but here are Milankovitch cycles, and then here is about the time since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. So that's the proliferation of internal combustion. So, you know, there's really no possible way to confuse what we have seen in the anthropogenic times with Milankovitch cycles. They're not different by a factor of 2 or 3. They're different by 2 orders of magnitude. So there's no way to confuse them. So anyway, so one thing is okay. So things here about this scale. So maybe 10 to the 1 or 10 to the -1. This would be, I suppose, what you'd think of as being biofluids and engineering fluid mechanics. As you get to smaller and smaller scales, so 10 to the -3 again is a millimeter. So 10 to the -6 is a micron. So somewhere around here, what starts to define these flows is surface tension starts to affect transport, and this is where we have microfluidics. I'll actually come back to this one because this is about also about the size of a grain of sand, okay, and then even smaller is a grain of dust. So actually Tapio Schneider made this quite elegant comment the other day about if you integrate the moisture profile through the atmosphere, it ends up being like the size of a human hair. And we have a similar issue, maybe it's not an issue, maybe it's a redeeming point. We have a similar issue in Aeolian, that we have these large scales of motion which are affecting transport on very small scales. So that's again why I think that this is Aeolian is a rich problem for fluid mechanics. Okay, so the next thing I've done is, I know there are many more experts in this room than this material, but is things, you know, blue are things in the ocean and red are things in the atmosphere. So the ocean's a bit slower than the atmosphere because the density is higher. Another thing to remember is, what will be the slowest and fastest environmental flows you could think of? So one very, very dramatic environmental flow that I could think of, and I know there are other examples, but one that I could think of is pyroclastic flows, which is these walls of rocks and ash that come crashing down the walls of volcanoes when they erupt. And sure enough, this is about the length scale and about the one divided by the frequency for pyroclastic flows. So this, you know, we could think of this as being perhaps the upper limit for environmental flows. And what about the slowest things? This is a glacier would be one of the slowest things that I could think of. And others doing pore-scale fluid mechanics would I'm sure have similar examples, but so this is it, and so this is this whole series of phenomena from micro and boundary layer turbulence through to all these different processes in the atmosphere, the cyclones, the planetary waves, and similar to the oceans, the geostrophic eddies, circulations, and these thermocline circulations. And so most of what I concern myself with is, and I think similar people in this room is things happening around this part of the space-time. So things at very high Reynolds number, so the Reynolds number so high that we effectively throw away any viscous effects. We generally do, sometimes we include Rossby number effects, sometimes we don't. And then also changes in the Richardson number. And so most of the time in my group, I end up doing convective stratification. Convective ends up being the most relevant for Aeolian, as you'll see towards the end of this. So this is where I tend to think, but again, this is one of the exciting things about fluid mechanics, especially environmental flows, is that we are in this sort of constant modulation, Aeolian erosion. So how does this happen? So some of you may know this and others don't, but I just thought I'll put it up here just for everybody. Basically, the wind can move around particles depending on how big they are. Things that are bigger than say 180 microns, which is about how big our hair is, 170, 180, those things are actually really too big to bounce along, and so generally they just slide to the side in what's called surface creep. If you're between about 30 microns and 180 microns, what happens is you bounce along the surface. And so anyone that's been walking along the beach since they've been here has certainly been a victim of this sandblasting. When you feel these grains of sand that are bouncing, they really just hop along the surface. And if you don't believe me, you could do a YouTube for like an Aeolian saltation. You'll see for yourself that that's really how they move. And then if they're very small, what actually happens is that, so less than 30 microns, they end up being mixed up into the atmosphere and then they're transported away as a passive tracer. Okay, so how does it happen? So if we think that the atmospheric surface stress, so this is the drag imposed by the atmosphere, if we just introduce a drag coefficient, which we would normally end up defining through the Mononobikov similarity theory, so here we have the product of density, some kind of drag coefficient, and then two velocities. So this would be the magnitude of velocity, and then this is the actual velocity vector. Okay, so here we go. So we can see that it basically is equal to rho u squared, u tau squared, excuse me, so u tau being the atmospheric shear velocity. And then here is our drag coefficient. Our drag coefficient, which I'm defining it here with the log law, which is one way of defining it. But there are other transfer functions that you can use. Okay, so for saltation mass flux, so this is the one that you felt when you're on the beach and you feel the grains hitting against you. Okay, so normally the thinking is that Q, this is the saltation mass flux. This is a series of things here you don't really need to be concerned with, but this is the one that I really encourage you to look at, is that Q goes like U tau to the N, and N is normally about 3. Okay, so that there it is. I mean, that's really the whole message. So Q goes like U tau to the 3. And so that, in my opinion, is really the foundation, really the main prevailing argument in why this is a rich problem for fluid mechanics. It's because U tau is changing all the time because of swirls and gusts in the atmosphere. And then what we end up doing is we go ahead and we take those changes and we multiply it, we take them to the third power. So everything gets exaggerated. And this is why I think this is such an exciting problem for fluid mechanics, is that these small changes in the wind magnitude have huge impacts for how Aeolian activity actually progresses. Okay, so why Aeolian? So this is just some, I guess, a little bit of elevator talk of why we do this. But there's all kinds. So these are dunes that are actually moving on Mars. This is some big dust plume that's left West Africa, and these are linear dunes on Saturn's moon Titan. Okay. So why Aeolian? So this was a problem. This was a story from a couple of months ago that made a bit of a stir. So this is actually a talk that this is actually stuff that I'd heard in conference talks at AGU for a couple of years, but now it's actually made it to the national media. So this is this NPR article, the Rocky Mountains have a dust problem, and what's happening is that dust emissions are being transported all the way to the Rocky Mountains, and they're being deposited in the snowpack. And when scientists when they dig away at the snow like this, they find layers of sand stratified into the snowpack. Okay, and so this has the main reason that this is important is because it changes the albedo of the snow. Okay, so it changes how it absorbs heat, which therefore means it accelerates melt. It changes biodiversity. It changes how water is managed. Of course, snow runoff is a big water source.
By how much does it change the albedo? What percentage?
I don't know how it changes the air, but I know that it changes the melt. It's like it happens like a month sooner, which is an immense difference. So it accelerates the melt.
Right, but wouldn't the acceleration of the melting be due to something else as well?
My understanding is it's due to because the snow gets darker, it absorbs more heat and it melts sooner.
Is this dust from Asia?
No, from the Southwest, from farming in the Southwest, Arizona, Texas, yeah.
Any sense that it's getting worse?
I don't know. I suspect that it is, because, I mean, we're hearing more about this every year, this accelerating snow melt. Yeah. Okay, so this is why Aeolian. So this would be one. So another one. So this was a problem from the, one of the New York Times expose articles from a couple of years ago. But this is living in China's expanding deserts. But this is in northern China. There's the Taklimakan Desert. This is a giant desert, and it's getting bigger because of desertification. So again, that's, you know, changing the way people live and so on. And then this is, I think I have one. So this is another nice one from the NSF so I guess 4 years ago. But there are these giant sand dunes in the Kalahari Desert, which had been static for a long time because they'd been vegetated, so the winds weren't able to mobilize them. But because of overfarming and because of grazing of cattle, they're actually being brought back to life, and the dunes are now moving again. And so why Aeolian is that? I think it's a really rich problem. So this is the first, having given all those examples from Earth, I'm going to go to Mars now. So here is Gale Crater, Mars. And so Gale Crater rose to prominence, has risen to prominence in the last couple of years because it's the landing site of the Curiosity rover. So this is the rover here, which weighed 2,000 pounds, which is like nearly an order of magnitude bigger than all the previous rovers. So actually, even getting the thing in the crater was kind of a revolution by itself. So this image is from the European Space Agency. So it was, I guess, the main author is Gene Newcomb, who's from this university in Germany called FU Berlin, which is kind of an unfortunate acronym, but that's what they went with. So that's what they're. So why this was $1 billion? The Mars Science Lab was $1 billion project. So why do this? So the rover was landed here, and it's been going across this plain, and then you see this dark region here. These are sand dunes. This is called the Bagnall Dune Field, and these dunes are actually alive. They're really moving because of swirls inside the crater. Okay, so it's made its way through the dune fields here, and it's been making its way up to the real target site, which is this mountain, which is called Mount Sharp or Aeolus Mons. Okay, so and so why do all this? And it's the following reason. It's really images like this. So this is an actual photograph from Curiosity I should have put this arrow like here, but anyway, you can see this layering of sediment here, and so. to us as engineers, we see images like this and we just think it's very nice. But geologists look at things like this and they see a whole history of what's happened on the planet. Okay, and if we see, this is what is called aeolian and fluvial stratigraphy, or strata. Okay, so if you see layering like this, it means that some processes happened at some earlier time where things were deposited and layered one on top of the other by wind and water. That's the only two ways. Okay, now. So that's the question then is, well, surely because of gravity that should have happened uniformly, and yet all we have now is this big sedimentary mountain. So the science question really is, how do we come to have this sedimentary mountain in the middle of a crater surrounded by a moat? Okay. So one of the things with Gale is it's a pretty big crater, so the diameter is 150, and the height of this mountain is 5.6 kilometers. So this ratio D over H is about 30. We'll come back to that ratio. Okay. So Gale is not an outlier. So here is Gale here, and you can kind of see the mountain in the middle. You can kind of see Mount Sharp. But there are other examples. So here is Henry Crater. You can see Henry has a mound in the middle. And there are, if you look at this image for longer, you'll see that there are numerous examples of this mountain in the middle of the crater. So this is not something. This is more general, I guess, than just Gale. This is something that has happened across the planet. Also, just for amusement. So this is Olympus Mons, which is the biggest mountain on Mars. So the elevation of this is 21,000 meters. So Mount Everest is 9,000. So it's a very, very dramatic planet. This is the science, getting to the science question is, you know, at an earlier time, the craters were filled. So the hypothesis that was put forward by Kristen Bennett and James Bell is the following, that the craters were formed by meteorite impact about 3.8 billion years ago, and then they were filled by water and sediment. So here we have the craters being formed, and then we have them slowly being filled by water and sediment. And that's where the stratigraphy came from that I showed in the image. And then what happened, and so the crater bombardment happened during a geologic time called the late heavy bombardment. Okay, and then what happened is around this time period called the Noachian, which is about 3.5 billion years ago, the planet underwent a massive climate change to basically completely desiccated conditions, like just no water or anything, just completely desert. And it has remained so for about 3.5 billion years. So you can kind of see where we're going with this. If it was filled by water and wind, and then the planet dried, and then wind was the only thing available for 3.5 billion years, then somehow wind must have played a role in emptying out this sediment, leaving the mountain, and so on. And so, if that's the case. What were the actual mechanisms? What were the gusts and so on? And so this is as far. I mean, Kirsten and James were geologists, so they put forward this idea, and so we were really testing this hypothesis. Okay, and we did it in the following.
What was the event that dried things, as people imagined?
Well, I after the late heavy bombardment, there was all this dust pumped into the atmosphere, so it may have been related to that. I'm not sure. So these are the cases that we considered. So we built these toy craters I just built these in MATLAB just using superposition of two-dimensional Gaussians. So here would be our time zero crater where the thing is entirely filled. This would be where there's been a little bit of emptying because of wind. Now we have an initial moat and a little small mountain. Now we have a complete moat, and we have our mound in the middle, and then this is a case where it's entirely empty. So you can think about each of these craters being some kind of snapshot along these periods in time. Okay, we didn't go to the trouble of mapping this to the time, but I suppose we could have. Well, anyway. And then we just put this as the lower boundary in our LES code, and we just started the code, and we just looked at the flow statistics. So I mentioned before about how, you know, the aeolian, the saltation mass fluxes go like U tau to some exponent like 3 or something like this. So it stands to reason then that fluctuations within the crater should be really of great interest to, in terms of moving sediment and so on out of the crater. So one of the first things we did is we generated a very long time series from these sampling points, so X2, 3, 4, and 5. And if you have long time series, you can generate PDFs. So these are the kinds of PDFs that we generated. And then we went back and we said, well, you know, this is a threshold here, this is about 4. So this corresponds with about a 10%, you know, 10% likeliness of occurring. So we ran the code for yet longer, and we did what's called conditional sampling. So that is, every time the velocity fluctuation at this sampling point, x2, exceeded this threshold, we just took a picture of the flow, we just sampled the flow. That's all. It turns out in turbulence that that's, as people know here, that's a really rich thing to do. So this is the kind of thing that we got from this conditional sampling. So this is one kind of initial. This is still a filled crater, and so this is you're seeing an isocontour of streamlined vorticity. So you're already seeing the presence of counter-rotating extra crater circulations. But as the crater starts to empty, you get something quite interesting. You get what we might call like a head-down hairpin. Okay, so this is the flow is coming this way, and so what you're seeing here is two of these vortices like this, and that ended up being quite a consistent pattern. So here is the flow going this way, and again you see. Let me make sure. Yeah. So you see these counter-rotating vortices like this, and so this is what we came to think of as being foremost in this preferential erosion of actually creating the moat and leaving the mound. If we have vorticity and it's mostly in the streamwise, what keeps it alive?
Just a question about the length scales here. So you've got everything based on a boundary layer depth.
That's right. Yeah.
And this is about right for the Gale crater.
Mars is the Wild West. So no one knows the density. No one knows the boundary layer height. So what we did is the boundary layer depth on Mars in my reading varies between about 5,000 and 10,000 meters, but again everything just gets normalized by boundary layer depth, and then all the simulations are neutral, which is another source of controversy in this too.
Those are enormous boundary layer depths.
I agree, but that's compared to terrestrial boundary layers. Yeah, it's quite right. But that's what is reported in the papers.
Yeah. And what do you do about Z naught?
So we model the obstacle as with a Mohs boundary method, and then we have just a low z naught all in the surrounding areas, and we set that to be some kind of value for like a terrestrial value for a kind of a low roughness.
But the tricky thing about sediment transport and why I left it is that z naught changes.
Once
you get moving sand grains, once you get...
Yes, that's also true, but... In these simulations, we don't actually have the surface. We don't actually have the terrain. We don't have morphodynamics. Okay, so the crater remains static, and we just evaluate the flow statistics. So you're quite right. Once there's a saltation layer, things change. We just don't have those effects. Yeah. Yes, Brad.
Mars has dust devils that are pretty. Does your simulation capture those?
No, we don't have dust. And Mars also has these. Anomalous massive dust storms, but we don't have morphodynamics, so we don't. Okay, so what sustains the vorticity? What keeps it alive? And so the way to do that is with the vorticity transport equation, but the Reynolds average vorticity transport equation. So if you do the Reynolds average vorticity transport equation, which comes from the curl of the Reynolds average momentum transport equation, so you have the advection term on the left-hand side, you have the stretching and tilting term. So this is stretching of streamwise vorticity because of a streamwise gradient in streamwise momentum. So this is like what we think of as the ballerina term, okay? And then this is tilting of streamwise, this is tilting, excuse me, of spanwise vorticity into the vertical because of fast spanwise gradients, and this is tilting of a vertical vorticity into the streamwise because of vertical gradients. Okay. And then finally, what you have, if you take the curl of the divergence of the Reynolds stresses, you get this, you get a term that we call the turbulent torque. Okay, and so that is how spatial heterogeneity in the Reynolds stresses actually induces rotation or removes rotation. So in general, this is called the Prandtl secondary flow of the first kind and of the second kind. And so when we look at these crater cross sections, so this is at one section, this is just before the middle, and then this is at a section in the middle. So this would be like if you're looking at the flow coming towards you, you're looking at a plane in the middle. So this is the stretching term, and so it's certainly elevated within the inner crater space, but let's see, it's only varying between negative 100. So it's varying between 10 to the 2 and negative 10 to the 2. When you look at the first tilting term. Well, immediately it's much bigger. So it's bigger by, you know, nearly two orders of magnitude. And again, it's more elevated, you know, close to the wall of the crater. That's true also for the second tilting time. So you can see we have these large valleys on the external and also on the inner. And then finally, the exciting result for fluid dynamics is the turbulent torque. So the turbulent torque ends up being a little bit smaller than the tilting, but larger in the inner crater space here. So you see these decline quite quickly, but the turbulent torque remains large. And then when you sum them all up, so this is the secondary flow of the first kind and of the second kind, you see that they end up being about the same order of magnitude. So if we compare this one and this one, they're about a similar order of magnitude, and they're both contributing to positive streamlined vorticity production here and negative here. So that was part of how we came to think of, well, where does this vorticity come from? Principally from the turbulent spatial heterogeneity of the turbulent stresses, and then also from the mean flow. So this is the model that we came up with that I won't. This is just again this argument that outside the crater it's really the tilting times, but within the crater it's both the tilting and also the turbulent stresses that are keeping the thing alive. And so this is the deflationary progressive. So this is really just some artistry, but I've drawn these lines on here. They're colored by positive and negative. So this would be, you know, like this and this. And so the thinking is that in early times we started with these two filaments, and once they get started, then the filaments just continue to grow and grow, and that's how the moat came to be. So we could do a little bit more with this. So since we had all this information about the flow, we thought, well, could we say anything about, you know, was it really possible to empty these craters in this time? So here is one thing that we did. So I showed those sampling points before above the crater. So this is the time series. And so one of the things is, if you have long time series like this, you can distribute the signal in joint time frequency space by convolving the signal with a spectrum of wavelet functions. And so that's what you see here, just for one of these cases, just for one of the craters. Okay, and then if you do this for each case and you average it over time, you get what's called global wavelet power spectrum. And that's what you see here. So the black line is for the full crater, and then the lightest gray is for the empty crater. And then the colors vary accordingly between the full and the empty. And so it's clear that, okay, so all of the craters exhibit the same peak here, and so what is significant about this? Well, if you introduce the Struhol number, which is this non-dimensional vortex shedding, and if you introduce the Struhol number of 0.25, which is the value that we really always get for high Reynolds number flows, and you use an L equal to the height of the crater, which kind of makes sense, because if you think, well, vortices are being shed at about the scale of the element. Okay, so if you sub that Struhol number in length in here, and then an average velocity above the crater, you get this blue band here. Okay, so it seems to make sense that the first peak we see is because of vortex shedding from the crater rim. Okay, what about the second peak? Well, the second peak is a little bit more curious. It only occurs for the cases that are empty or almost empty. You see, so the light gray is the fully empty, and then the dark gray is the case with the biggest moat and the isolated mountain. Well, when we again sub in the Struhol number of 0.25, and then, well, what would be a length that would make sense for that? Well, I suppose the radius. I mean, the radius would be some length for these circulations that are within the crater. We ended up finding this second peak here. So we thought that was a pretty good result. And then going a little bit further, so could wind have really have emptied this crater? So if we, again, I guess I'm an engineer, but if we say, well, this is going to be a model for the crater fill, so it's going to be a circular cylinder with a diameter d and a height equal to h, okay? And we could set this up as a control volume and then say, well, the dmcv dt has got to be zero, and that's got to be because of a change of mass within the control volume in time plus the mass flux being removed. Okay. We could then say, well, this term here, we could evaluate that just by integrating over the surface, and this is so that we're just going to set the partial t is just 1 on dt. Okay. And then we take these to the right hand side, and we'll have these models here. So this is these models for mass flux. So this is a model for mass flux by saltation, and this is a mass flux by dust emissions. Okay. So the Q and F are these models. So Q is one of these models from the 60s for the saltation mass flux, and F is the dust mass flux. Okay. In general, we end up defining the dust mass flux in terms of saltation. Okay. So yes.
Could you explain the difference between the saltation flux and the dust
mass? Yes. So the saltation mass flux is how the bigger grains, so between about 50 and 180, how they actually bounce along the surface. Once they start to bounce, they enable more bouncing, and then they also enable any dust that's stored within to start rising up. So the dust is the really small stuff. So you could think about this as being mass flux of the bigger things and mass flux of the small things. And the mass flux of the small stuff is really predicated upon the saltation having already gotten started.
So that's hence the proportionality.
Yes, that's right. So I just sub these two things into here, and then you can get a deflation time scale just by doing a little bit of algebra. And so this is the deflation time scale, and if you sub in our ratio of d over h equals 30, and then the model for q, you end up getting this as the deflation time. But it's not really right, because the whole argument and what the wavelet analysis showed is that all of the energy is stored by these rollers that come by, and then things go quiet. And then another roller goes by, and then things go quiet. You see? So it would be like if you were standing here, you experience this thing first, and then quiet, then this thing, then quiet, then this thing. So we really have to rescale the deflation time. Fortunately, it ends up being a quite easy exercise, and so we can just multiply it by after a little bit of algebra, you multiply it by 1 on the Struhal number, so you multiply it by 4. Okay, and so what you're seeing here is this is our deflation time compensated for the exposure to these eddies going by. Okay, this is a range of u star values, so this is the friction velocity in the atmosphere that this surface feels. Okay, and what you have here is a series, so these are all different profiles for different densities, since the density on Mars isn't known. Okay, so here I have a typical value of 10 to the negative 3. These are some intermediate cases, and then this is 10 to the negative 2. So firstly, let's see, it makes sense entirely that as the u star gets bigger, we should empty the crater sooner, because that's the atmosphere is imposing more drag. It also makes sense that as the density gets bigger, we should empty the crater sooner, because the atmosphere, again, is capable of moving more sediment. The pleasant result we found from this is that when we use values that have been reported in the papers on Mars or for U star, and when we use some typical values for the density, we end up finding that there is, you know, it took, what, like, what is this, you know, three times 10 to the, so this is about 3 billion years. So the basic science question is, could wind have moved all of this sediment? And it's an immense amount of sediment, but could wind have done this if left to its own devices for 3 billion years? And it certainly appears so. So that ended up being the result there. And so we published this, and then the American Physical Society, they do these focus articles. So they ended up writing a focus story about this, which was a nice outcome. So one of the next things I wanted to talk about is there has been this quite a lot of interest, I would say, the last 10 years or so, looking at these large-scale motions in the atmospheric boundary layer of Earth or any other moon or planet. Yeah.
Sorry, before you go on, can I just ask a question? So on the moon, a number of the craters have this sort of central mountain,
yes,
which I think is due to some rebound after the impact.
So it's funny. Someone asked me that same question the other day. So, but that you must appreciate that is an entirely different phenomenon.
Right.
And those mounds, if you sampled them, they would not have this sedimentary layering. So the sedimentary layer, that's the key thing. So those mounds are not because of some kind of impact. They're really because the mound was empty, and then wind and water gradually filled it up over time.
Right. I was just wondering, when you published your paper, if there was any discussion that said that, you know, some of the craters in Mars were formed by this process, and some were formed, or some of the central mountains were formed by this rebound.
No one made that comment, but I showed this stuff last week, and someone said the same question. So it's, but when we were doing the paper, no one gave that comment actually, But again, I think that, I mean, certainly, why don't we do this? So there is clearly, I may have to show you, I mean, there are numerous cases if you look at this. I mean, this is a crater within a crater, but this is an empty crater. So the basin goes in, and then it's flat. So if there were remnants of what you're talking about, I you would see it in the rock. But the only mounds on I know that other moons are different, but the only mounds that on Mars are these ones that really are the product of this sediment layering. Yes, of course.
I have the same question in mind, of course, yes. But about the rebound, about the fact that you find sediment on the mountain, the central mountain, do we have a clear identification of all the layer, or you find sediments only on the top of the mountain?
Well, that's, I don't know, and I don't think that the rover has core samples that would be deep enough to resolve that. I honestly, I don't know. But again, if there was rock to do with this, you know, there's the impact and then the rock comes back up, I think that just like the walls of the crater that are made of rock, that would still be there. But what you see on Mars is that you either have the sedimentary mound or it's just empty. So,
And there could be a difference between the central part and the border. Some years ago, we published a paper on the possible waves on Mars.
Okay.
Given the possible size. And some people report, I don't know if it is in the crater, but probably you know better than me, certainly you know better than me, that there should be some identification of the effect of wave, because the wave were invoked at the time as a possible explanation for some geological shape that we find.
Yeah, you may. I don't know. I honestly couldn't say. I mean one you know yet other confounding factor here is that these craters all night they have catabatic flows that are crashing down the walls of the crater and down the side, and there is a competing hypothesis that these were actually built in place by catabatic winds that deposited the sediment, and over time that grew up. But I think that, I mean, clearly there are catabatic winds. You couldn't possibly. But I think in terms of catabatic winds having made this entire process, having created the mounds in place, I have an issue with that, because if that were true, I mean, at time zero when the craters were filled, I mean, in this case, well, catabatic winds are the product of density differences and slope. But at time zero, there was no slope. So the very mechanism needed to create them wasn't there. So, so that's another compounding or a confounding. But again, all the simulations that I'm showing and everything we've done is for neutral.
Thanks.
So there is. Okay. So this is this. So in the last 10 years, I guess I would say this has really been, and even before that, people were thinking of, you know, coherent structures in wall flows, but these very large scale motions in the atmospheric boundary layer, and so what we've been doing is looking at what the significance of these may be for Aeolian activity. So just for some context, so in the atmospheric surface layer, these things. So if we think of the boundary layer being 1 kilometer, which changes of course all the time, and then if we have a simulation domain of say 6.2, and then a length of I know you can't see this, but let's say 24.5 kilometers. So these structures here are meandering through here all the time, and so this, in fact, the length of them is one of the reasons that they're so challenging for simulations. Is just because the domains have to be big, and we either have to do much bigger simulations or we have to compromise on resolution. So if you were to look through this is from a neutral simulation again, but if you were to look at a plane through here, so a plane in the X and Z, so this is the kind of thing you see. So at each elevation, I've removed the plane average, and so what that does is that makes it more vivid, and so what you see is this successive series of, you know, momentum excess, deficit excess, you know, excess, deficit, and I've actually annotated this. I put a series of these red lines on here, and this is the inclination of these things, and so that's been 15 degrees is what I put on here. It could have been 17 or 14, but that's about the value that is commonly reported, and that's been well known for a long time. But what's known is with these VLSMs is the general thinking is that they're the product of coalescence of these successive LSMs. And you can kind of see it here. So this is looking at it. If we look at a plane here, and then we go and kind of look down on top of it. So looking in the X, Y. So here again, you see these long streaks. And so here is one big long momentum deficit. And I've just highlighted this as the silhouette of this thing. We'll come back to the silhouette. And then finally, this would be looking at the flow as an instantaneous flow as it comes towards you, and you see these momentum excess and adjacent low momentum. And so the question is, if these things are there all the time, and they are, what does this mean for Aeolian activity at some sampling point like this? So the first image you're going to this image is what's called a spectrogram. So the spectrograms are a really beautiful way of looking at turbulence. So what we do in the community for no real good reason is we put elevation in the horizontal direction. So this is what we've been doing forever and ever. So here you see. So here this is z divided by the boundary layer depth. So 10 to the 0 is 1. That's the depth of the flow. And then here is the first sampling point. So 10 to the 1. This will be what you would think of as our surface layer depth. Okay. So we have wall normal elevation in the horizontal, and then in the vertical we have wavelength normalized by the flow depth. And so here I've normalized these by h. So this is this kind of silly annotation, but I didn't know what else to use. So this is the depth of the flow divided by itself. So it's 1. Okay. So we see in here this is this pile up of energy, a spectral density. This low line here is the resolution of the simulation, and this longest length is the length of the flow. So all of the energy, of course, has to be distributed between this largest and smallest wavelength. And so here we're seeing all the very traditional pileup of energy that you would expect to see. And then we see that this is really diminishing as you get further from the wall and longer in wavelength. And then there is a plateau, and then it starts to pick up again, and we have what is the beginning of a second peak. And this is the signature of these very large scale motions. And you can, in fact, you can just map it back to the wavelength here. So here we see this 20, what is this, 20 and 30 here. So if the simulation had been let yet longer, you would in fact see a distinct outer peak. And so the question is, not so much what do these mean for Aeolian activity, but what do these mean as they're going by for Aeolian activity?
This isn't sampled at the for the high stress events, right? This is not.
This is just sampling of the entire flow.
So I guess you'd see maybe more evidence of that larger scale peak if you focused your if you just did averages over those condition on that sampling. Is that the case, or do you think you just basically see the same?
I'm not following you.
In the graphics you showed before, where you were doing composites or sampling over the higher wind events,
yes.
Right, or the higher stress events, you saw these structures. I was just wondering if those structures would be highlighted better in that diagram if you did the same kind of sampling to construct that diagram.
Yes, I suppose you would. If you did the spectrogram of the conditionally sampled flow, then yes, you would just be. I mean, that would be tantamount to a low pass filtering, I suppose. Yeah. So if we think that we have this hierarchy of structures, how do these affect Aeolian activity? So this is one of the first things we did, is we just generated a very long time series of surface stress from this sampling point here in the simulation, and so these are for three different resolutions. So this is more negative, so this is the biggest stress, and this is less negative, so these are the lower stress events. And so one of the first things we started doing is just doing conditional samples of the stress. So every time the stress exceeds one of these thresholds, we just take a picture of the flow. Okay. So this is the conditional sampling equation. For these thresholds, alpha, beta, and gamma. So here it is. And so what you're looking at here is the conditionally sampled flow. And right away, what you see is that when you look at the conditionally sampled flow for one of these extreme stresses, so this is extreme high stress, you see this big excess of momentum. Okay, and here you see this excess of momentum, and it's also the vectors here, the spanwise and vertical velocity. So you see that this excess of momentum is flanked by downwelling, counter rotating downwelling vortices. And when you sample the flow based on low stress, you see this big parcel of low momentum. And here you see that this low momentum pool is flanked by these adjacent rollers that are pumping velocity up from the wall. And so this length here ends up being significant. So this is like the length of these large-scale motions. So the story ended up being that these stresses, these peaks and valleys in stress, were really the product of these large-scale motions going through the flow, momentum excesses and deficits. We've been doing some work in more recent times of looking at how does surface heating affect this. And so this is just showing a PDF of the surface stress as you change the zeta, which is the stability parameter. So it's quite a obvious result here that just as you increase the surface heating, you have more extreme stresses. So the last thing I wanted to, I think I'll just jump to the end here. So the last thing I wanted to show was something from a few years ago, working with a friend of mine from the USDA, and he has this long-term experiment in West Texas where this is Texas, and there is this area called the Llano Estacado, which is this flat area, and so he has this long-term experiment where he's been measuring simultaneous wind and saltation at this site. So here is his anemometer, and here is this sensor. So it just records grains bouncing against the sensor. Okay, and so just showing this equation again, and so this is the Bagnold scheme for the saltation mass flux, and you've seen these things. We could use the Mononobikov similarity theory to define the U star just with this, and the denominator here is the stability correction psi m. So here are the values for psi m for unstable and stable, and so you can rearrange this equation to get the vertical gradient of velocity, and so. What we've been doing here, just jumping straight to it, is the following. So if you imagine that this is the range of zetas from negative 2 to positive 2, so this is our convective, this is really the daytime, and this is stable, so this is the nighttime. And then in fact, this is from the measurement. So this is midnight, 6 a.m., 12 noon, 6 p.m., and midnight, and it just goes round and round again, and then it's averaged over over 9 months. So what we did is we used the Mononobikov to make this range of U stars that the atmosphere could possibly develop. And then we put a U star T, which is the threshold for the site that had been measured. And so the result that we got confirmed something that had been well known for a long time, but it really made it clear through the Mononobikov, is that during the daytime is the only time that the atmosphere is really capable of mobilizing the sediments. And at nighttime, the wind blows and there is geostrophic pressure. But the atmosphere, because of stable stratification, is not actually able to move the sediment grains. So that was the result. And I think that's the last figure. So I'm not sure how I am with time, Baylor. But sure.
Yeah, you're doing fine. We'll discuss for a while longer.
Okay.
But that's good. I'm still trying to absorb the figure.
So what we did is we took the U from the site. Okay, and then we used a range of different stability parameters, and so with that you could make this contour of the U star. So this is how U star changes, and then this red line here is the U star T for the side. So the U star developed by the imposed by the atmosphere has to be bigger than U star T in order for sediment to move. And so all this is showing is what you would expect, is that during the daytime, because buoyancy is producing turbulence as well, U star gets bigger. And so it's only during the daytime at this particular site, although there are others where this is true too, that the atmosphere is able to move sediment.
Do you know what happens to the very large scale motions when you move into the convective regime?
Oh, well, that's so I was going to talk about that, and then I decided to jump over it. But they get steeper, okay? So the very large scale motion that the prevailing sentiment is that you have large scale motions, and they're the building blocks of very large scale motions, and they coalesce into these long trains, and normally there's 5 or 8 of them. When the surface gets hotter, these things get steeper. And they get steeper, and if the individual constituent large-scale motions are steeper, then the very large-scale motions have to get shorter. And so this is the picture that we have of this. So this will be a neutral case, and then This is some pool of low momentum fluid encapsulated by hairpins. And as this thing gets hotter, these structures just get steeper. This is just me just drawing on my computer, but this is a true thing. This has been recorded. So here we have the absolute value of the stability parameter, but this is all from the convective regime. So here we have effectively zero, and the inclination angle, gamma, is 15 degrees. But as you get hotter and hotter and hotter, these things start to get steeper and steeper. And there's an obvious upper limit on this also. They cannot get any steeper than 90 degrees. Of course, 90 degrees corresponds with free convection or Rayleigh-Bernard convection when you just have these plumes of fluid. Yeah. So there is quite an obvious transition from between purely shear driven and purely buoyant.
May I ask a follow-up to that?
Of course.
So this was the topic I was hoping you would elaborate on. So over forest canopies, I think there's been some work done on the transition from neutral to convective. And I guess a question you could ask is it the hairpins that change their shape? Or an alternative is that you've got plumes and hairpins and the population density changes as you change stratification. And I think over the forests there was some evidence that it was the latter explanation, it was the population density. So I just wondered if you could comment on that or whether your data could shed light on that.
We have not, so far this thing of the steepening of the structures, we have not. So we have tried to look at mechanisms. We've done things like, again, I didn't show it, but we've done things like these contours are the Reynolds stresses due to, where the yellow is due to sweeps and the black is due to ejections. And we've done similar things where we've tried to do quadrant analysis, but with W prime theta prime to try and mechanistically connect the observations with actual events. But it is much more difficult. We've found it to be that explanation, I'm afraid we haven't. One thing we've done recently is that there's been all this flurry of interest in this amplitude modulation ideas if this is the signature of these very large scale motions as they're going by, how do they change what's happening in this part in time? And so one thing one of my collaborators and I have been doing is actually looking at amplitude modulation and frequency modulation with changing stratification. And so for the neutral case, the dominant modulator is the streamwise velocity fluctuation. But as you go to increasingly more unstable conditions, so as you approach Rayleigh-Bernard free convection, the streamwise velocity has virtually no modulating role on the inner fluctuations. And the real modulator is the vertical velocity fluctuations. The funny thing is we tried doing correlations also looking at how theta prime modulates the inner layer, thinking that, but we found that we could not actually show that it had a significant modulating role. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah,
great. So, there no real difference between free convection that at one limit and, strictly neutral shear turbulence at the other in terms of the transport or suspension or. You mentioned saltation,
but
so you just look at your tau, and that's all.
That's right.
That matters.
Yeah. So you.
It doesn't matter.
I don't know if, for example, things like. So as we do it, U tau is the input argument, and then as a result of that, the particles jump along. Now I suppose you could think, if you think about it in terms of the Obukhov length, if the saltation layer is less than the Obukhov length. Then the grains as they bounce along will really be confined to the shear or dominated layer. And as you go to free convection, of course, the Obukhov length is zero and the entire thing is dominated by buoyancy. And then the hopping of the grains, they may go on different trajectories. I don't know, Greg. But there would still be some kind of dominant. There would still be some kind of transport direction, even for the free convection. Even if it's predominantly the turbulence is predominantly vertical, these things would still migrate. So I still think that there would be some kind of. I'm not sure about this if the net saltation transport goes to zero in the free convection limit because. Yeah, I'm not sure to be honest. Yeah. Yes.
Have simulations been done of the actual dynamics of dust grains, or sand particles, in perhaps with some synthetically generated wind?
Of course, there are people doing morphodynamic turbulent simulations all the time, but it's this whole, we have disparate length scales. So we have the, if we do sand grains, they're a little bit easier, and even those are 150 microns, and then dust is 30 microns. So trying to resolve individual grains while at the same time having sufficient energy in the turbulence is very challenging. So there are people that are working on this, but in the end, the inertial conditions end up being quite low is my, yeah.
Well, I was wondering if there's a very significant drag imposed on the fluid by the dust grains themselves.
So of course, this was the question. The other gentleman had that once you have a thick saltation layer, a thick, then these end up changing the mean velocity profile. They give it an inflection, just like you would have in flow over a canopy. Yes.
Since I was mentioned, going back to the surface roughness. A long time ago, I was involved in some wind tunnel experiments looking at turbulent flow over hills. I emphasize I did not set up this experiment. So there was a surface roughness on the bottom of the wind tunnel, but the hill itself was smooth. And that change in roughness really affected the speed up over the hill, the flow separation, etc. I noted you pointed out, Bagnall June said that the surface roughness is obviously changing quite significantly over this crater feature. Have you looked at all at
No, we
have
don't.
Any it's to look at.
Yes, of course. I mean, the aerodynamics of your question are perfectly well posed, but the way we do it numerically, we have a Cartesian mesh, and then we have the obstacle that gets projected onto the mesh, and so we don't have a way to actually change the roughness length, and so that's why we haven't done it. But I'm familiar. There's also Ned Patton at NCAR. They've done these, I think, with you. They've done these things where they've changed like vegetative density over these little hills, over hills, and it changes the aerodynamics. So your question is physically well posed, but we haven't done it.
Somehow this is connected to what I will talk in 2 days from now. This is a generation of wave by wind on a different scale.
Yes.
Because when you generate, you produce roughness on the surface of the waves, but the waves are practically like an accordion that is pulling and pushing. Therefore, you move the surface, you change the roughness on the surface of the wave, different on the front and the back, this changes completely the wind speed.
So are you meaning, this was all neutral, so we don't have gravity waves, is that you?
This is all over wide.
Okay. I'm simply saying that.
Okay.
I'm not commenting about this, because this is a comment about the hill that reminds me of what is going on out there on the surface of the sea when there are waves of the smooth. Actually, the level of smoothness changing from the front to the back, but it's a completely different problem. I'm just not grasping from one problem to the other one.
The depth of the flow remains fixed, whether the flow is approaching the crater or above the crater. So we fix the H, so we don't allow it to change.
No. It was a general comment of mine, just something, a logical link. It's not a comment of what.
Okay. Oh, I see. Okay.
Another thing that, again, something similar but different. This process is not really scouring what you see, but this formation, of the. I've seen something similar on the snow in the mountain after a storm. As soon as the way there is a small obstacle emerging, there is scouring.
It's
a shape.
So there is always they call it the necklace vortices. That I mean, this is also in river hydraulics as well. The scour around piers is quite a, but it's again because of it's in fact something not particularly different to like this necklace vortice that's around the element, and as these things rotate, they scour out.
Yes, but it's called also before the obstacle, exactly because of the effect of the wind that is going down, and the effect that you were showing is the beginning when the wind is entering your crater in Mars.
Yeah.
So you mentioned it would take 3 billion years.
That's right. Yeah.
I think it's a long time.
But it's a lot of. But remember, it's a lot of. It's okay. So the diameter of this 150 kilometers. The depth is 5, and then so that's your volume, and then you multiply that by say 2500 for the density. So when you do that, you could probably. So what is it? So 10 to the. So it's 150 kilometers. So that's. Was it 10 to the 5? So 10 to the 10, and then say 10 to the. So you're talking about an incredible amount of sediment. So, and you're talking about a thinner atmosphere too. Okay, so you have two competing things. But what we found is rudimentary though it is, if the atmosphere is left to its own devices over this very very long time, it's able to move this enormous amount of sediment. And again, so Mars is thought to be the ultimate planetary laboratory for Aeolian. There's nothing else. It's only wind. At the caps there is ice, but these mid-latitude craters are far from any ice effects, any ice transport.
So over 3 billion years has the atmosphere changed?
That's another question we don't know the answer to. So we in the scaling we did at the end, we used a uniform value, but we also could have envisioned something where you had a negative declining value for density, and then when you did the time scaling, you could just integrate to recover that effect. We didn't do that, but.
And what happened to wasn't there a theory that water was on Mars?
It was. It absolutely was. Yeah.
So
water was one. So I was open about this. So here is wind and water that filled up these things, but this was during this pre-desiccation time. Okay, this time is relatively short. So this is Noachian time, but this is when the planet underwent its massive climate change to desiccated conditions. Yeah. So certainly, wind and water were active in filling of this and creating the stratigraphy, and water samples have been found all over the place. I mean, there are these from the group at JPL that were on the Mars Science Lab. That was some of the first. They have these two science papers, each with like. I beg your pardon?
Those drippy things, the big salt things that came out of the.
That's right. Yeah. So that's the water layers that are the traces of water are there's nothing controversial about that. That's a known fact. Yes. Yes.
Although that's recently been questioned whether that was really water forming those sort of rivulets on the craters.
Not rivulets. They actually found. I guess it was in the mineralogy that was evidence of that. Not the fluvial layers.
Yeah. Separately, there was a claim that there were these things that were seen on the edges of a crater that looked like
water bead. Okay.
Little rivulets.
Okay. I wasn't actually aware of that, but they like the lacustrine. I think they say that. But certainly on the plains they found. I wasn't aware of that, Brad.
The standard theory or standard story of how Mars lost its water is that, first of all, it's a very small planet, so the gravity is weak.
Yeah.
And it also doesn't have a magnetic
field. Yeah, the magnetosphere. Yeah.
So the solar wind comes and blows off the atmosphere. And maybe 4 billion years ago, it still had an active convection in its interior, so it might have had a dynamo, a magnetic field, and it protected the water and the atmosphere. But then that stopped, and then it lost all of its atmospheric mass, and so it became much colder, and the water went away.
Yeah.
I wanted to know a little bit more about this slide here. So as curiosity proceeds a little bit, do you think there'll be any imagery that'll kind of help guide you in your next steps?
We've wondered about that. So maybe not with this, but one of the things, the next steps of research. It's kind of a funny story with this Mars stuff. So I've been doing the same thing for really 10 years, this LES of the terrestrial atmospheric boundary layer. And beyond you know, politeness in the community, no one really, you know, cared. And then we applied the same thing, but to a different planet that nobody lives on. And all of a sudden, there are these, where did it go? All of a sudden, I've lost it. All of a sudden, there are these PR, there are these APS focus stories, and they put a story on the university homepage. And so the NSF put it on their homepage for a brief time. So, and it was also funny because
around to George Philander's point, that was the name of the professor you were mentioning.
Yeah.
You know, we do mundane things, right? The word mundane is related to our whole planet, and then when you translate it into something else that people actually think is cool.
Yeah. But that was the funny thing is, around the time that the NSF put it on their homepage, I also had a proposal on this topic that was under review, and it was just a couple of weeks later that it got rejected. So we have tried this. This work is
So politeness only goes so far. Community politeness.
Yeah, but this work is the topic of three rejected proposals now. So, but we're going to keep.
It was actually a serious question. I was just wondering if there's any guy. I mean, you're saying the geologist.
Back to you. Yeah. So not so much.
Is there anything that we could get from them that would help?
No, although one of the things we argue on the proposals is that the results could be used in rover design in terms of one of the problems I have with the rovers is dust. It gets everywhere and it's a mechanical problem. So maybe not so much to that. But one of the things so satellite imagery has been used to and I don't have it here, but they studied these aeolian features like aeolian streaks. Also, one of the things that the geologists do incredibly well is that they can look at the inclination of the dunes, and from that they can reconstruct the wind field. And then there are other aeolian features like that. And so when they look at those long-term aeolian wind markers within the crater, they reconstruct a similar wind field to what we found.
Are there any sort of wind measurements, turbulence measurements on that on the?
So the values of the U star that we show at the end in the scaling, those are actually from these science papers are cited as the candidate values.
Are there any anemometers or anything on the?
I've heard that there was talk about that, but of course weight is always a massive So.
But they have microphones, don't they?
I think they have that, but then I heard that they had. One of them broke on the landing or something like this. But
microphones It's interesting thinking about those microphones. They might give you some insight into the diurnal cycle and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, again, the simulations are all neutral. Of course, neutral is the part of the atmosphere that is occurs the least frequently, but. You know, it's
In terms of what the data might.
No, I understand.
And what about the effect of these global dust storms that occur on Mars?
Yeah.
Do they impact the erosion characteristics significantly? Do they happen frequently enough that we need to worry about them?
We haven't looked at that. I couldn't say one way or the other. To be honest with you.
And I guess more broadly, is a dust storm normally? Does it have density driven? Winds. I mean, like, why? It's a significantly different regime.
It's
elevated dust, right?
That's right. And then even so in those so surface chemistry and electrostatics, which are things that we. You know, normally as turbulence people, we just think that the Reynolds stresses are responsible for everything in the world. But there are, you know, that I mean, seriously. But there are other things that we haven't even considered that are part of that.
I think the radiation is very important with the dust storm. So the temperature will tend to go up because the dust is almost like a greenhouse gas.
In this figure, you can see that there seems to be this deep mode on one side and shallow on the other, and then you have the schematic layer where
it's just a basin
asymmetry as well. Yeah. If you, and that's probably in the downstream direction of the mean flow, right?
It's a good question. So we don't capture this in the simulations that we did with these idealized two-dimensional Gaussians. We don't capture that. But you're quite right that this it's almost like the shape of a Barkin dune. We didn't include that.
Even though you had a mean.
Yes, that's right.
So the symmetric the asymmetry in the wind is not enough to make an asymmetry in the evacuation.
No, it may be. I'm just saying that we didn't consider it in the simulations in the topographies that we considered.
But as you saw the evolution, did you see it just appear because you had a zone or some sort of wind that you were imposing?
So what we did is these symmetric cases. So we didn't, and we made.
How are they forced?
I beg your pardon?
How are they forced?
Well, we have a pressure gradient forcing, just like a standard atmospheric boundary layer setup. Yeah. So one of the things we have, your question is quite fair. One of the things I have thought about, perhaps a better way to have done this, would have been to have done this first simulation and then tried to reconstruct a stress field from the LES statistics, use the saltation and dust emission models to figure out what the first emptying stage would be, and then run another simulation on that and sort of have it hop forward in time and see if we could capture that kind of thing. But we didn't do that. But that I think now, maybe that's the next thing that we should do, because that to me seems much more physically sensible. But yeah.
But just based on your physical understanding, which I think is in the next slide or something.
The mechanism?
Mechanism, right? So this mechanism, these hairpin vortices, are they oriented in the downstream direction of the wind?
Yes. So this is, you can see here, that this is X. So this is the main transport direction. And we have this head-down hairpin, which is like think of it as like the scour vortices. But something different, though, is that the spatial heterogeneity of the Reynolds stresses induces this turbulent torque that both produces and removes streamwise vorticity.
So maybe you can go to the theory of production of Barkin genes, which have somewhat similar flow characteristics to that.
Yeah, of course, Barkin's because the flow separates and it gets faster around the outside.
But if you were to look at all the craters on Mars, you see some asymmetry.
No, that's another nice question. So sometimes we do see it, and then other craters you don't see it. That's in terms of shape. Now, what is known, and I hesitate to open up my computer because it ends up. So what is known is that the shape, the Barkin-like shape, that ends up changing. Okay, but what is actually quite general is actually from this group that the center of this thing, it always ends up being radially shifted in the downwind, and that's quite a general result. So the shape of the mound changes, but the parcel always ends up being shifted. Yeah.
But if you put a sediment transport model in your system, you could evolve the...
Yes, that's true, but you must remember that we have this, again, we have this disparate timescale issue. I think a better way to do it, though, is this kind of jumping forward. I think that would have been, because then you could have done a simulation over a brief time and then jump forward, I don't know, 300 million years.
So you could calculate the sediment transport.
Yeah.
So over a given shape.
Yeah. Yeah. So that would have been, but in terms of the coupling, that's just this. Yeah.
That's a stick problem. All right. Thanks very much.
Okay. Thank you.